first order of business will be the confirmation hearing. For the nominees, Mr. Gorsuch, Attorney General, nominee, would you come forward, give your name, and present any testimony, and hopefully answer all questions truthfully and concisely.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Norman Gorsuch, and I'm a nominee for Attorney General. Just take a brief few moments. I'd just like to give a little background sketch. Was born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, 40 years ago. I've been an Alaska resident since 1967. I worked as an associated partner at Ely Guess and Rudd, a law firm in Anchorage, from 1967 to 1971. In 1971, I was appointed Deputy Attorney General and moved to Juneau from Anchorage under former Governor Egan. And I served in that capacity until 1973. In 1973, I was appointed Attorney General and served in that capacity until the changeover administrations in December of 1974. From 1975 to 1982, I was here in Juneau as a partner in the law firm of Ely Guess and Rudd. I occasionally lobbied, and in 1982, I was appointed by Governor Sheffield as Attorney General nominee. And that's a brief overview, Mr. Chairman. Knowing your desire for briefness, so I'll answer any questions.
Do you now or in the next 4 years have confirmed and intend to apply for a state loan? I must caution you before you answer.
I have no further intention to do so.
Oh, okay. I am. Senator Ziegler?
I have a question, Mr. Gorsuch. Norman, I shall call him because I've known him for a long time. It's come to my attention, sir, that in recent years, for want of something better to do, I assume, you have been known to plant rumors in the legislative hall to see how fast and how far they could travel. But there was no basis in fact for these things that you said. Is this true or not?
Well, on occasion, I did conduct experiments to see how rapidly they could move, yes. They do move quickly,
sir. I wouldn't continue that line.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question. You going to move off the fourth floor before we confirm you and your officers?
I think that that's, of course, a subject for discussion and analysis between the governor and the legislature. I am simply go where I'm told.
Well, that opens up a whole new approach.
Almost everywhere else.
That's all.
Senator Dorsey?
Are there any relationships or experiences in your private practice that could create a conflict of interest as to any aspect of your work that you foresee? And if so, what are they and how will you handle that through other officials in the department?
Well, the only direct conflict that I would be aware of at the moment is the case involving the lawsuit in which my former law firm is representing the legislature in a lawsuit against the executive branch dealing with the power of the governor to veto. And I have
recused. You can agree with the legislature and avoid conflict.
Well, I could, but I feel a little rather awkward. So I have recused myself from that case and the deputy attorney general is that is the only direct conflict that I am aware of in terms of litigation. I did conduct an analysis of the current status of the conflicts canons and determined that this particular lawsuit is the only particular conflict that I have.
Senator Pennington?
I take it that since you left the Department of Law in December 1974, that you were not involved in the settlement of the Montacuch matter, or were you?
I was there when the lawsuit was filed, I think that was 1972, and was involved somewhat in the initial strategy involving the lawsuit, but I don't remember when it was settled. I think it might have been settled after 1974, but I can't be sure.
I believe, as a matter of fact, it was settled after you perhaps you left. What role did you play in the partial settlement of the Cleary litigation?
What role?
Yeah.
The role I played in that case was, upon assuming office, I reviewed the matter with attorneys in the department handling this matter, discussed the status of the case with Mr. Andell, the new director of the Division of Corrections, and reviewed our options, which were very limited at that time, in that the stipulation had been executed by the previous administration in November, and participated in one oral argument seeking a delay in the effective date of that stipulation pending the time for analysis by Roger Andell and his people, so that we could get a new administration's position on it, and have been since then working with Mr. Andell to develop our strategy and tactics with respect to the remaining issues which were not settled by stipulation and which are still outstanding. And we intend to, at the moment, it's intended that those issues will be litigated in June.
What's your view of the situation where the legislature simply failed to fund the settlement of the query matter, in the sense that there were not sufficient monies appropriated to allow the Department of Division of Adult Corrections to do the things that it's agreed to do in the stipulation?
Well, in the stipulation, my understanding is that the cost for the issues which were resolved in the first stipulation is rather minimal in terms of $300,000 to $400,000 a year. With respect to the balance of the issues, my understanding is they could run from $4 to $7 million a year, depending upon who you talk to. And I suppose that the real issue would become whether or not we would be acting pursuant to an order of the court or not. The court found after a contested trial that certain things should be done, then presumably the officials in the Division of Corrections would have no choice but to request that funding from the legislature under court order. And should the legislature choose not to appropriate that money, I assume that there's a possibility those officials could be held in contempt. There's a possibility the court could seek to mandamus the Treasury. We haven't explored fully those issues, but I would suspect that perhaps a defense could be raised if a good faith effort was made to present that to the legislature, and the legislature turned it down, and perhaps the court might restrain itself in terms of dealing with the corrections officials. But we really haven't researched what our options would be should that event occur.
Okay. Well, you kind of understand where I'm coming from, Mr. Bush.
Sure.
The basic question that underlies what I'm driving at is, what is the role of the Attorney General's office and of the administration in resolving complex, important public policy issues in litigation by the route of a settlement? And I think that Molly Hooch and I'm thinking clearly. And I am a little uncomfortable with the thought that a lawsuit can be filed involving major public policy decisions, and rather than litigate the matter and get a judgment from the court as to what the responsibilities of the state may or may not be, the administration or the Department of Law makes a determination of what the court's judgment would be if there were a trial, with all of the attendance and uncertainties that calculation necessarily involves, and signs a settlement, obligates the state, and the legislature is in a position of either giving you the money or and perhaps leaving you open to contempt charges, or the other possibility may be that the court could adopt other remedies, such as releasing prisoners from jails if their rights under the settlement are not protected or observed. So that's a real cause of concern for me.
Right.
And if I could continue, Senator, I'd like your reaction to that problem that I have as far as what. How are you going to approach that if that comes up in the future? It's an issue in a clear case, and there probably will be others.
Well, just to reiterate, when we entered office on December the 6th, the settlement stipulation was executed. We were not in a position of deciding whether or not to execute it. It was a question of delaying the effective date of the agreed-upon judgment until we had a chance to familiarize ourselves with it. But, as a matter of general policy, I think the function of the office and the function of the department is to render legal advice that is the best professional legal advice that we think we can give. And in my judgment, there are certain risks attendant with litigating something to finality, which means that in effect, whenever the judge finishes, one does not know where he will come out. So it's a question of judging the odds, assessing the risks,
and making a recommendation to the executive branch. And in turn, should that require funding, hopefully in conjunction with discussions with the legislature, concurrently with that, perhaps arranging to see if funds would be available to resolve the issue. I think you always have to balance litigating it to finality with an unknown result or a potentially grave result in terms of cost impacts and perhaps, in this particular case, restrictions on the operation of the correction system versus assessing a reasonable settlement that maximizes flexibility and perhaps minimizes costs in presenting that option to the client, in this case, the executive branch. And then hopefully, as I say, concurrently in the future, we would prefer to discuss this with the legislature so that there could be some feeling as to whether or not the legislature would see fit to fund that system.
Senator Josephson, Mr. Gorsuch, speaking for myself, I would be just as uncomfortable if a nominee for Attorney General came before the committee and said that the Department of Law was going to settle nothing and have these important decisions made only by judges. Because then I don't think you'd be doing your function as a legal advisor, and I would be just as uncomfortable having a non-elected, traditional sense non-elected judge make these judgments as I would have the governor who is elected making them the advice. So, for whatever that's worth, I think there's a balance to be struck. But litigation, what is the status of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline case? What can we look forward to in regard to its resolution? And what,
gentlemen, I'm going to allow a little leeway, but this is a confirmation hearing. It's a qualification, not as to what pending other litigation.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I thought there was a problem. Just permit me.
Sure.
Thank you.
Sure. As you know, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission ruled that the TAPS methodology, that is the methodology for computing tariffs, was to be remanded back to the administrative law judge to develop, in effect, a methodology for the TAPS pipeline, because the TAPS pipeline is a monopoly in terms of shipping oil from the North Slope. And the Williams Brothers case, which was the general generic pipelines tariff case pending in the courts, left the question open as to TAPS pipeline treatment. So we have, in a sense, gone back to square one with respect to methodology, which is the big ticket item in terms of the tariff. And that is scheduled probably at the moment under the FERC schedule. We have just arranged for commencement of hearings again in January next year, hopefully briefing and pre-filed testimony and cross-examination can be completed by October or November. So next January is when we would commence hearing on the methodology issue. This June, we commence hearing on the question of the cost overruns issue. And, so we're looking probably at some kind of concurrent activity before FERC throughout the summer and fall of this year. Now, we have, of course, requested continuation funding for litigation expenses, both in the FY83 to conclude the balance of the funding, which the legislature did not conclude last year, and also through FY84 for a full funding of the estimated cost of pursuing this case and a couple of other cases we have.
Senator Joseph, perhaps I should comment you. The idea, at least in my understanding of the confirmation hearing, is to establish any defects in the ability or qualifications of the applicant to question them as to policy matters. He is under the client lawyer restriction, I would imagine, this as well as anybody else is, and he is the legal advisor to the chief executive, but such as responsible for him. He would give advice, just like you would give me advice on whether I took it or not. I don't mind going a little far afield, but to interrogate him on questions of policy, that he is not the one, he is not the he forms public opinion or helps to shape it, but he is not the final decision.
I believe you have some correspondence from me on this question.
Correct.
That you
we are,
received.
Yes, we are awaiting some analysis on some of your questions with respect to antitrust. discussing some others, and so we hope to, probably easiest for us to provide a briefing for you or something.
Does any member of the committee, can any member of the committee identify any defects in the building or qualifications?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I believe whatever defects there may be, the governor's entitled to have his own attorney general.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have any further questions on the defects of this candidate, or the lack thereof. But I do have some questions on some policies that aren't necessarily going to be adopted by him in his capacity as Attorney General. And if that is not appropriate to bring up at this time, I will drop it. But if I'm only restricted to his qualifications, I have no further questions. If I can ask him about some policies which he may be adopting in his office, I would like to have one or two more questions.
Well, not
with regard to any specific litigation.
If the policies are something that would create a defect in his ability to be an attorney general, that's fine.
Well, it's not his ability that's in question in my mind, Mr. Chairman. Nothing is in question.
Just like the chairman of mine, too, would like to question Mr. Gorsuch, for example, as to how he felt about the reimposition or the reinstating of the death penalty, but that has no bearing in this hearing.
That's a substantive matter, and I'm not going to ask you a question like that.
You don't mind.
How do you feel about it?
You don't answer that, please.
Thank you, Mr. If there's no other questions,
let me ask if this is appropriate. He stated, Mr. Chairman, that in the event that there are settlements of major pieces of litigation that involve fiscal impact with regard to such a thing as the Molly Hooch decision, which I understood cost the state $140 million, he says he's hopefully going to run it by the legislature, and I'd like to know how high his hopes are that he'll do that, and in what circumstances his hopes will be, they won't be met with regard to that.
You like to answer? You don't have to, sir.
I think that the execution of and prosecution of civil and criminal litigation is a function of the executive branch. The settlement of cases is a function of the executive branch. I think it's only good comedy between the branches of government, which would dictate to me certainly a good faith effort to inform any kinds of settlements which would have significant cost impact. But as you are aware, Senator, we do settle cases throughout the year and submit a supplemental judgment appropriation for your group of cases. And I assume you're not talking about those, but
no. Perhaps
those of major implications. And I would hope to consult with the legislature on the implications of settlements for sure, and all that some sort of. I can't guarantee that, depending on the circumstances.
Is there any member of the committee finding any defect in the ability or qualification of the nominee?
Mr. Chairman, in all seriousness, I think that when Governor Sheffield nominated Mr. Gorsuch, there was broad satisfaction among the public with our feeling that he would bring experience to the administration. And I believe that the governor's done extremely well bringing Mr. Gorsuch back to the
government. Well, the only reason for my question is required formality, at least in my estimation, because I'm going to have a correspondence or communications to the Senate and to this committee. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Robert J. Sundberg, nominee for Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety, would you please come forward, identify yourself, sir, and either give your resume or respond to questions, etc.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Do you know, Commissioner, do you know the senators at all?
I'm Bob Zucker.
Senator Zucker, Senator Josephson, Senator Pettyjohn, Senator Elias.
Thank you. Nice to be here, Mr. Chairman. My name is Robert Sundberg. I'm the nominee for the Commissioner of Public Safety. I've been in Alaska since 1950. I was married in Alaska. Four children born in the state. I'm still living here, still living up in Fairbanks. My police experience was back to 1954 when I first was employed by the Territorial Police as a dispatcher and then went on as patrolman of the Fairbanks Police Department in 1955. Went through the ranks of the Fairbanks Police Department and retired as the Chief of Police in 1976. In 1976, I went with Elias and Pipeline Service Company as a security manager during the peak of construction and the startup of that operation. And I resigned from that job in 1978. The reason for the resignation was I didn't want to move my family to Anchorage, primarily because of the son's schooling. And,
you prefer to live in general.
Then right on.
We're trying to find out.
Primarily because of my son's schooling, I didn't want to move to Anchorage, so that's why I left that job. I didn't want to disrupt his school because he was doing very well in Fairbanks. After I left Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, I did run for the city council in Fairbanks in 1978 and was elected to that office, and I was re-elected again in 1981. And resigned that position when the governor requested that I take this job in the state of Alaska. So that's a brief summation of my activity in the state of Alaska. I haven't had many jobs, I've pretty well stuck to it.
Commissioner, are you familiar with the responsibilities and requirements of the position of Commissioner for the Department of Public Safety?
Yes, in general, I am. Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Litter?
No questions.
Senator Joseph?
Best wishes.
Thank you, sir. And
you remember the police standards commission?
Yes,
I forgot to mention that. Senator, I am now as the Commissioner of Public Safety. Prior to that, I was a member of that commission or council since 1972, and I just resigned the public seat I was holding, and the governor is going to fill that. The Commissioner of Public Safety serves on that board automatically while the Mr. in office. So I resigned the seat I held since 1972, yes.
For the reason that I might say I have good friends as a member of that commission, and he recommends you highly.
Thank you. Thank you.
Any other questions? Does any member of the committee know of any defect in the commissioner's ability? Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks, Senator.
Next, we have Senate Bill 55, which the Vice was asked to put together a letter of intent. We also have Mr. Barrier here. Mr. Barrier?
You identify yourself.
My name is Billy G. Barrier. I'm director of the Vice Public Services.
As I remember it, on line 17, there was a question.
Is this a committee substitute?
Yes, this is on the committee substitute. There seems possibly a dichotomy between lines 17 and lines 11, and we're talking about lines 12, a proposed agreement, and on line 17, we're talking about an agreement that will take effect. In other words, an automatic. And
yes,
there was a thought that perhaps the word may take effect. In other words, if we say it takes effect, then we are, in fact, agreeing to all of the terms of the, in other words, that's where the evasion again possibly could be. So we wondered if perhaps the word may would fill, would fit the gap in there.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I think that it would. I would suggest if you make that change, just for sheer grammar, I would make it the agreement may take effect. Very, very minor change. But yes, I think it would accomplish what you're looking for.
Does that satisfy you, Mr. Senator Joseph?
I have no problem. Actually, the what we call the letter of intent is language that I was proposing for the paragraph. But I don't know what that
means. Mr. Chairman, I don't know what your intention is, sir, about moving on the bill or the adoption of the intent, but I would request that we take no dispositive action of the so-called letter of intent by Senator Joseph, because I want to get together with him and see if there can be some language clarification. If that's what this thing is, because I may be wrong, but I'll talk it over with.
committee, it was my intent to make the amendment language, changing the word and to the, and before the word takes, put the word header, the word may, and eliminate the S off of takes as a committee amendment. And I would allow Senator Dibner and Senator Joseph to get together on the letter of intent. And as soon as I am satisfied with the letter of intent, I will sign it. And then we'll be submitted to vote for reporting. If it's reported out of committee. And we're going to try that now. I'd like to take the final conditions.
I didn't mind the last part.
Going to amend it. Did you get that part?
Yes.
And Senator Joseph and Senator Dibner are going to get together on the letter of intent. The letter of intent is agreeable to the attempt.
For sure.
And the chair, I will sign that. And at that time, I will submit this to the clerk for your action. If it moves in the future, at this time.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I wrote a serious question on this a couple days ago, and it didn't seem to be a question anybody else was either interested in or thought was a problem. But I'd like to run it by again, and if I'm not. The question is if the executive were to reach an agreement with the bargaining unit within, say, 10 or 15 days of the adjournment of the legislature, and if it was submitted on, you know, 2 or 3 days before the legislature were adjourned, the provisions of this bill would, as I read it, would mean that the agreement would go into effect even though the legislature only had a couple days to put that into adjournment to it. That's not a problem.
I don't think that the reason I say it isn't a problem is that any opponents of the agreement will be certainly alert and there will be action on it immediately, believe me. If there's anybody that's opposed to the agreement, there'll be a resolution to pop out in 15 minutes if there's a special order of business and pass it without us.
Very well.
I think I've seen it done in the past many times, and I don't know, if something of this magnitude, I'm sure that nobody would let go by if there was a defect in it. Senator Austin.
Of course, we discussed this a number of times, and I still, you know, maybe I just can't understand what we're really doing here, but.
I have a little, it bothers me just a little to think that we are in some manner or other binding the hands of the future legislature or binding them to an agreement which, you know, if they don't take action, they're a part of the action. I don't know. My question is that, can we bind future legislatures under this process? I mean, that sort of bothers me. Aren't we really getting their freedom to act one way or the other by saying this will happen if we don't do that?
Don't we do that in any event, on any proposed agreement to the sign, if it's a two-year agreement, we're binding to the future legislature to sign in?
But I'm saying, what we're saying here is, you know, do something, buddy, you agree with it. Now, I don't know if that's not that much difference, but maybe the whole thing should be looked into as far as restricting the action of the future legislature. I don't know.
I don't anticipate that as a problem.
Maybe I'm totally wrong on it, but it seems to me that, if, for example, we made a decision last year, and we have a new body before us, and we're saying, well, you're going to have to, you know, get your act together within 30 days. You don't act, this is going to happen. And I don't know if we have that right to tell them they better act or this is going to happen.
Well, we do it with a budget process, and when the bills come down, and when the cutoff date is, and all the rest of it.
No, we're not really saying that. Well, the problem I have is we're saying if you don't act, it means you approve.
Yes.
That's the whole problem.
Yes.
No, I don't.
Is
there a problem there, or am I missing something?
No. If I understand what you're saying, I think you make the point that in every other situation, the Assembly must take affirmative action by a majority vote of each House. So this puts the burden the other way around. But I think the original intent was to have the legislature participate.
To do something, right. I understand what we're trying to do, but I was wondering.
I don't think it's a legal problem.
Well, I understand where Senator Lyons is coming from, and he is right that we cannot bind future legislatures. You know, by action, we dictate we can't bind 1985 legislature.
Which can repeal this bill, by the way.
That's the answer to your question, I think. We can't bind those on the books. They have to live with it, or
find, now wait a minute, fellas, don't get into some kind of cockamamie idea like that. We find every legislature, they have to have
the word cockamamie.
Well, they have to have, you have deadlines in which every legislature must meet certain deadlines. What are you talking about? It goes on and on and on. You got buckets, you got everything. What do you
think? The point is we're laying down long-term policy.
Well, we do it.
Okay, all right, so you're right. So he's right. He's saying what can be done about this at a future date. I don't think we
need to repeal it.
This is what, okay, and that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's a...
But this point is not...
Chicken and egg.
Without merit.
No, I understand what you're saying, but I'm going on the advanced theory that we have all kinds of rules.
We have a law which says we should have the budget before the body's within a certain date. And the last 2 years, 3 years, we haven't done it.
We have.
The roof hasn't fell in.
That's because Senator Ray's not on the Finance Committee.
We have a statute right now, that says executive orders become law within X days.
How about the Boundary Commission? Same thing. It becomes final unless something happens. See, the reason that we're putting that you must take some kind of action is if you don't take action, it just goes on and on and on and
well,
on. And you're making them do something.
Maybe this brings into question all the other things we have that are already there. Maybe they haven't been tested. I don't know. But I mean, I have just a little reservation about having to act nor not to act. I see what we're trying to do. You're trying to best it, get it behind us, force us, but I think it's a good idea.
You either do one thing or the other, so everybody knows where they're coming from.
That's the idea,
but I don't. You can argue whether it's going to rain tomorrow.
That's our will.
I mean,
I don't know. Does this bind us that it is going to rain tomorrow? Or?
I'll book on it, that's for sure.
Okay. I don't mind you bringing that argument on that floor if you want.
No, I'm not agnostic. I just don't
want to see if I can make something. I think primarily you had a question, which I think has been addressed. Has it to your satisfaction? Mostly?
Not really.
Not really. I've had this question for, since this thing came before us, 2 years now, I guess. Pastor wants to know that.
Yeah.
Maybe we're going to have to find out when we get right down to that point, whether or not we have to do it or don't have to do it. Maybe that's the kind of thing we'll be. At least it gives us something to, a deadline to meet. If we don't meet it, maybe we'll rest it easily. But
if this doesn't move in the committee, there might not be a future. Including the chair. Right, Jerry? I understand what you move to report the bill and the correct. With the letter of intent, yeah. Is there an objection to that?
The letter of intent might be.
These 2 days of letter.
We can do that right now. We'll do that right now.
How many do pass?
I'm going to go right.
Okay.
When you get it into a marital, a family relationship, you're changing the whole idea of the Violent Crimes, the original act. I have no argument with it if we are decided that we're going to take care of that end of it. I don't have any argument with it. But what I'm saying is that we are, in effect, changing the whole original concept. I think Senator Joseph will agree on that. Although I think, again, that he might substantially agree with the new direction of the familial relationship.
Well, I think this letter of intent probably will pique some people who would say that it's not sympathetic enough to say to a woman who is battered by her lover, but it does follow what I think was the discussion, which was that the first priority is really the stranger. The existing law may need to be changed because of some hardship in cases such as the minor that we heard reference to, the stepfather or someone who murders his mother that he's economically dependent upon. So I think if the letter of intent will alert the board to where we're coming from, and they must under the existing law consider these other factors and implied or expressed consent anyway, but this Surrey tells him that the committee wants them to look at that very carefully.
So we've already signed this. Senator Eliason, you were not present that day. If you would like to sign a recommendation, or if not, the bill is still in control of the committee.
I have a question while Senator Eliason is pondering that report. You were signing this bill.
Somebody walking down the street and a guy runs up and shoots him, and they have no relationship or anything else, and they are a victim. And it's not for two people that are getting along in the same house, and or maybe they have a very good relationship, and they say, "Well, honey, how about beating me up and get a new car?" You know, which isn't too far fetched if you read the reports that come out of the violent crime. Yeah. Have you read some of those?
Yes, yes, but Senator Joseph,
he's corrected that now.
Yeah, but the letter of intent specifies that the board, in the exercise of its discretion, has to give consideration to all these factors that would go in to their granting or denying an award.
You
mean,
saying anyway, you want
the letter of intent means anyway. I think it says U.S. vote.
I did that. Here's the guy that's going to get up a car for you to sign it. He gave him a script.
He's going to be a carpenter. I'm going to refer the question to the chief carpenter.
You'll be ready to answer on the letter of intent, right?
Here you go.
Oh, we both would. Anybody would, for that matter.
I'm sorry I missed that meeting. But maybe that's a stupid question, maybe it isn't, but is a victim of a rape by eligible for violence crime compensation?
Yeah, but the it's not sort of like for emotional distress. It's for medical bills, lost wages. There's some limited categories, so.
But, you know, the state has gotten into that arena here 2 or 3 years ago where, you know, we can't. Rape is a crime of violence, which even within a marriage structure is still a crime of violence. So I don't think it's just a point of new ground, really.
We are actually, the new ground is that we are setting a precedent that we're responsible for family relationship quarrels in which somebody gets walked on. And I don't know if that, although realistically, that the injury still occurs.
Well,
it was a piece of paper, and I think you still get.
Mr. Chairman, you know, as long as we've got a couple minutes here, I can see where a lawyer would go in and sue the state because these troopers didn't respond quickly enough to an emergency situation involving domestic violence and use this bill as an argument in favor of the fact that the state does have a responsibility to protect people in domestic violence situations. Which is sort of, I think, what you were saying.
Mr. Chairman, the New York Times Sunday reported that the new governor of New York has sent a package of bills to the New York legislature. I've called for that package. One of the things that is in that package is a requirement that violent offenders may be required to reimburse the Violent Crimes Compensation Board of New York. Now, they don't have a general fund thing, so the mechanics are different, but we're going to get that and see about that.
It's not a good idea. I mean, certainly not every person who commits a violent crime is penniless, and some of them do have resources, and they could.
He's got a specific proposal that if you are put on work release after you've been in prison,
confinement, a portion of your earnings is lien.
Dedicated
to reimburse the fund for the violent crime.
Look into it, because that could be a matter of, you know, of an additional bill for you. if you're content with it. That's not a good idea.
We have yes.
For civil further, I know it's interesting that they would compensate the board. How about the others? That, you know, I mean, other specific
well, compensate the board, then you're making more money as available to other people. See,
but
right now, Dick, you weren't here.
But the lady who testified on behalf of the board said, hell, they run out of money every year about this time. They've never had an increase in funding since they were put into business about 8 or 10 years ago. They're still running on the same bare bones budget they did then, and so she, Mrs. Camp said, we're out of money.
Well,
no, we've had 40 or 50.
I understand the point. The point I'm trying to make is the fact that the state is very interested, obviously, to put that money back into the company so they can be put out in the other arenas. However, I found in our particular state there is not that much interest after you award a claim in court, and they're to make restitution, and that's as far as they go. They're not all that interested in enforcing that restitution.
Well,
but now you're saying the state's going to force restitution into a board that is functioning as part of the state government.
And there's another aspect.
So, you know, maybe the whole thing should be looked at.
There's another aspect that we're working on, which is that if you commit assault, or someone commits assault on another person, and there's a criminal conviction for that assault, and then there's a civil action brought against the offender for that violence, you know, the medical bills or whatever, the offender who has committed the crime can invoke all of the civil protections against execution of assets, which we have in Title IX of the statutes, and that may be something we want to do. That's what you're talking about.
Right.
I don't know, there may be federal restrictions.
Gentlemen, let's miss while we have a couple of minutes. We have Senate Bill 20, that's the judicial retirement system. Senator Zibler, I know where you're not at that.
Okay, sure.
Senate Bill 24 relating to the Somali peace officer. We have new language. Did you see that?
Came to my office today.
Right.
I haven't had a chance to look at it.
So we'll bring that up on Friday. Senator 40, we're working on that. 41, Senator Eliason, this is relating to transfer of ownership. You know the background of that from research. Senator 49, Fritz, we're aware of where you are on that.
The teleconference is Friday.